This is the follow-up to my guide to classical liberalism. If you have not watched that yet, I would recommend doing so before continuing. Now, I have maintained that ideas matter, and generally, real-world events tend to trail the political theory. For example, most of the thinkers I discussed last time wrote in the late 18th century, but it would not be until the mid-19th century that political practice would follow theory here in good old Blighty. Parliament passed a slew of landmark classical liberal acts that would usher in the greatest period of prosperity ever witnessed in human history. These acts include the Catholic Emancipation Act of 1829, which scrapped old Reformation-era legislation dating back to James I, which prevented Catholics from becoming MPs and denied them various other rights. The Reform Act of 1832, which scrapped those notorious rotten boroughs you may have seen in Blackadder. And, of course, the repeal of the dreaded Corn Laws in 1846, which finally allowed the population to start to boom as corn prices could now fall and supply could increase to meet demand. As one can clearly see from these graphs, this not only precipitated the great divergence between West and East, but also had Britain breaking away from its long-term rivals in Europe. Now, for whatever reason, Charles Dickens's descriptions of conditions in workhouses in Victorian London are what captures the public imagination. But as Milton Friedman frequently pointed out, the reality is that workers' wages increased over 90% in just 50 years of the freest expression of the free market that we've ever tried. Here are the raw numbers from Phyllis Dean and W.A. Cole's British Economic Growth from 1688 to 1959. You can see here that by 1906, not only were people paid more, but there was less unemployment, 100 in 1850 versus 194 in 1906, adjusted for inflation. National income per head in 1913 pounds rose from 21.2 in 1855 to 48.6 by the time Edward VII was on the throne in 1905. This is an increase of about 25% per head per decade for 50 years. If people wonder why I'm such a staunch supporter of laissez-faire, here it is in real numbers, done by economists without any agenda at all. And as you can see from this table, it was a diversified economy in which no sector dominated or accounted for more than one-fifth of the total economy. Note here that revisionist Marxists and other leftists like to claim that the financial success of the British Empire was primarily built on exploitation, but these numbers slay that myth absolutely. Look at the number I've highlighted here. At the height of the empire in 1907, only 7.2% of income came from abroad. In fact, most overseas territories were a net cost for the British taxpayer as opposed to a net gain. In other words, Britain's economy was booming despite the empire, not because of it. And it was booming because of its classical liberal stances on economic affairs, its relative lack of interference with business. The decade-on-decade growth for industrial production from 1800 to 1938 is phenomenal, being hampered only by the First World War, and even during that decade, it grew by 4%. Many modern economists on the left like to argue that in the event of a recession, government needs to intervene and provide fiscal stimulus to aid the recovery. But during the 19th century, there were many boom and bust cycles, and the British government did virtually nothing in the way of fiscal stimulus. As we have seen, the British economy kept growing despite all of this. Boom and bust cycles are natural correctives to market inefficiencies, and out of the ashes of creative destruction, in the long run, more people end up better off. England in the 19th and the early 20th century was a shimmering beacon of personal liberty for the world. As the historian A.J.P. Taylor put it, until August 1914, a sensible, law-abiding Englishman could pass through life and hardly notice the existence of the state, beyond the post office and the policeman. He could live where he liked and as he liked. He had no official number or identity card. he could travel abroad or leave his country forever without a passport or any sort of official permission. He could exchange his money for any other currency without restriction or limit. He could buy goods from any country in the world on the same terms as he bought goods at home. For that matter, a foreigner could spend his life in this country without permit and without informing the police. Unlike the countries on the European continent, the state did not require its citizens to perform military service. An Englishman could enlist, if he chose, in the regular army, the navy, or the territorials. He could also ignore, if he chose, the demands of national defence. Substantial householders were occasionally called on for jury service. Otherwise, the only people who helped the state were those who wished to do so. It left the adult citizen alone. But despite all of these stone-cold facts, unfortunately, no sooner as the fruits of classical liberalism blossomed, voices from the left and from the right started to try to put controls and curb the free expression of the markets, and accordingly, the individual wealth and prosperity for the greatest number of individuals. One such voice was Benjamin Disraeli, who invented a form of conservatism called One Nation Toryism. Such wet figures in the modern Conservative Party, such as our current Prime Minister, Theresa May, and the former Prime Minister, John Major, come from this tradition. Disraeli wanted to appeal to working-class men by promising that the government would intervene on their behalf by passing various health and safety laws. Disraeli saw this as a solution to worsening divisions between factory owners and workers, and he sought to mandate protections out of a sense of noblesse oblige, that is, the basically feudal concept that the nobility had an obligation to be generous and honourable to their social inferiors, like kindly parents. But in this, he was working directly against the spirit of classical liberalism, which emphasises the free association of individuals. A true classical liberal, and I am one, would argue that even in this case, where it seems that the workers have been taken advantage of by unscrupulous factory owners, the workers do not have to work at those factories. They do have the option of walking out. They do have the option of working for the factory owner who does provide a safer environment. The market itself can solve this problem without Benjamin Disraeli's benevolent paternalistic interference. If you want proof of this, what government mandate told Google to install PlayStations and relaxation centres in its offices? Or what government mandate told them to give their employees free gourmet food cooked by top chefs? We can see today in Silicon Valley that without any government interference at all, organisations are competing to get the best staff by offering the best perks and making their offices the most attractive places to work. Why does anyone think that factories are any different? So, in any case, the Tory party itself was largely one of paternalistic government encroachment on business in exchange for working class votes. Now, this makes more sense when you consider that, at the time, their opponents were not the Labour Party, who did not yet exist, but the Liberal Party, who were originally the Whigs. William Gladstone, Disraeli's great rival and the Prime Minister for much of the period of tremendous growth I've just shared with you, was a staunch advocate of laissez-faire, low taxes and a balanced budget. Gladstone is a true hero of classical liberalism. Unfortunately, the party was soon to be hijacked by so-called modern liberals. As opposed to classical liberals, modern liberals were obsessed not with allowing the market's free expression through laissez-faire policies. They are obsessed instead with welfare reform and increasingly interventionist policies which forcibly reallocated funds through categorical decision-making, basically the complete opposite of classical liberal principles. To understand this, we need to understand what was happening in political philosophy. Jeremy Bentham had founded utilitarianism, which saw society essentially as a mathematical puzzle. If individuals were the chief unit of measurement, then organising society should be a simple matter of maximising the total amount of happiness, which we can then work out by counting the total number of happy people. Many have speculated that Bentham suffered from an acute form of autism because he seemed to assume that human beings could be measured in this way. In this assumption, he violates a core classical liberal principle and commits what F.A. Hayek called the constructivist fallacy, which is the belief that social institutions can be the object of successful rational design. And it does not take a genius to see how this belief would result in somewhat illiberal and interventionist policies. Bentham's protégé was John Stuart Mill, who, in an incredibly famous book on liberty, tried to square utilitarianism with classical liberalism. People might debate how successful he was in this, but as soon as you concede the point that we should, in some circumstances, reallocate resources by rational central planning based on whatever utilitarian calculations, you've violated a core tenet of classical liberalism and embarked on the long road to socialism and, of course, beyond that, the road to serfdom. One key mistake that Mill makes is in trying to make a distinction between production and distribution in economic life. He wants to say that we can keep production going as it is right now, but then take the output from that production and reallocate it to areas with the greatest need, as defined by utilitarian calculation. This is economically illiterate because the whole system of relations are inextricably linked. A change in one place in the economy will likely result in a change in another place. To give an extreme example, if you taxed, say, a wool factory 90% of their profits, then you cannot expect that wool factory to maintain its current level of production. Indeed, the factory owner might get out of the game altogether. Let's pretend lumber mills don't come with this 90% levy. Maybe he goes and opens a lumber mill instead. So now you've incentivized factory owners and the textiles industry to do something else. This failure to consider long-run effects for those proposing government interventions would be an enduring issue that continues through to this day. I would recommend Henry Hazlitt's Economics in One Lesson for countless examples of this idiocy. So unfortunately, by 1906, William Gladstone's influence in the official Liberal Party had declined, and the new modern Liberals, who were all about these welfare reforms, replaced him. People like Herbert Henry Asquith and David Lloyd George took over the party. So now you have a situation in which, after almost a century of untrammelled prosperity and growth, both the Conservatives and the Liberals had turned their back on and abandoned laissez-faire and were actively interventionist and big government in their thinking. A symbol of this regrettable development is in the 1909 People's Budget, in which David Lloyd George and the young Winston Churchill, crossbench allies, passed a budget promising to eliminate poverty. Lloyd George said this: "This is a war budget. It is for raising money to wage implacable warfare against poverty and squalidness. I cannot help hoping and believing that before this generation has passed away, we shall have advanced a great step towards the good time when poverty and wretchedness and human degradation, which will always follow in its camp, will be as remote to the people of this country as the wolves which once infested its forests." So what did this budget do? It increased taxes, put huge levies on landowners, which would have the long-run effect of sending most of the great houses in Britain, which had been there for centuries, into ruin. A big increase in death duties, aka inheritance tax, and a form of protectionism on international trade by sticking bigger tariffs on imports. This was indeed a war budget, but its target wasn't poverty, it was prosperity. Government control over the economy and eventually over many other aspects of people's lives continued to grow, and this was exacerbated by the triple whammy of the First World War, the Great Depression, and the Second World War, which between them massively expanded the government's power while killing off the classical liberal voices in the mainstream. By this time, the Liberal Party, who had sold out their principles to become quasi-socialists, were overtaken by real Fabian socialists in the form of the Labour Party. They were busy building a welfare state to look after its citizens, as the saying goes, from the cradle to the grave. Incidentally, in the USA, all of this had a parallel, and the net result was Franklin D. Roosevelt's New Deal. On either side of the pond, the post-war consensus was that classical liberalism was dead. big state, one nation Toryism and Fabian socialism were basically in agreement that a big nanny state was required. It was only when all of this started to fall apart in the most catastrophic way in the 1970s, where here in the UK we had the winter of discontent and the three-day week, and over in America, New York was on the brink of bankruptcy, that classical liberal voices started to be heard once again. Some of the most important of these include Ludwig von Mises, who wrote very extensively about why government intervention ultimately works to impede growth and prosperity. Most of his books can be found for free on Mises.org, but a good starting point is his collection of lectures, The Free Market and Its Enemies, from 1951. F.A. Hayek, whose classics The Road to Serfdom, 1944, and The Constitution of Liberty, 1960, I'd recommend. Karl Popper, whose The Open Society and Its Enemies is an essential anti-utopian, anti-radical text. Milton Friedman, whose Capitalism and Freedom, 1962, and Free to Choose, 1980, are very clear-sighted articulations of the core classical liberal vision. J.L. Talman, whose Origins of Totalitarian Democracy, 1952, is a damning critique of both Rousseau and Vladimir Lenin. Isaiah Berlin, whose Two Concepts of Liberty, 1958, is an exemplary statement of the classical liberal outlook and a warning against utopian radical concepts of freedom. James M. Buchanan, whose Calculus of Consent, 1962, outlines public choice theory and points out, among other things, that the incentives of politicians are not aligned with the best economic outcomes of their nations. Some of the voices in this revival of classical liberal ideas after World War II, such as Murray Rothbard and Robert Nozick, took these ideas to their logical extreme to become what we call libertarians or anarcho-capitalists who wish to abolish the state altogether. Now, I do not include these thinkers as classical liberals because there is a utopian streak in their thinking which is at odds with the classical liberal tradition and what it's all about. Anyway, all of these philosophical and economic writings prefigured the mainstream political rebirth of classical liberalism in the form of Margaret Thatcher here in the United Kingdom and Ronald Reagan in the United States. Unfortunately, history does indeed tend to be cyclical, and lessons seldom stay learned for long, because we once again find ourselves, as in the period from 1906 to the 1970s, without any real proponents of classical liberalism on either side of the aisle. Socialism on one side in the form of Jeremy Corbyn, and paternalistic one-nation Toryism on the other side in the form of Theresa May. In fact, to my knowledge, there is only one true classical liberal willing to stick his colours to the mast in British politics today, and his name is Jacob Rees-Mogg. Till next time. I'd like to thank Son of Tiamat, Cult of the Lich, Tyson Powell, Ginger Bill, Charles Vinson, Edward Darrah, Blake Barrows, Michael Pert, and Nathan Pullum.